and to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of God's Tathagata's words.
Are we starting now?
We're starting to rewind.
We're starting to rewind?
No.
These clappers.
David, the fast take one.
I want to go back to this poem that makes reference to the sixth patriarch. You know, he gets after he gets the bull on the road, he leaves in the middle of the night. He gets chased by all these people, and one of them catches up with him. And so you remember that one, okay? Mumon's commentary on this is: of the sixth patriarch, it has to be said that in an emergency, he did something extraordinary. He has a grandmotherly kindness. It is as if he had peeled a fresh lychee, removed its seed, and then put it into your mouth so that you need only swallow it. And so last time we met, I talked about peeling, like coverings, like thought coverings, and seeds, like the seeds of like karmic seeds.
Ramon had other arrangements.
So I was just making reference to this koan that we'd been talking about last week, and Ramon's commentary about the lychee. Do you remember that? Okay. And so I made some sort of interpretation about the peeling the lychee and the thought coverings. The seeds that were taken out, sort of like the karmic seeds. Later, Stuart caught me. He says, "How come you didn't say anything about the fruit?" I said, "Gee, I didn't think anything of it." Because fruit is pretty typically the way in which one speaks about the effect of one's actions, i.e., the future that emerges out of the present. Fruit is a standard term that's used for the outcome, the fruit of one's actions. So I was slightly embarrassed to have noticed that I missed the totally most obvious aspect of this completely. And then shortly thereafter, Sonia gave me this verse from the Dhammapada. Actually, it's the very beginning. It's in the first section. And apparently this is the way the Dhammapada begins, and I sure didn't remember that. What we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind. If a man speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows him as the wheel of the cart follows the beast that draws the cart. What we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind. If a man speaks or acts with a pure mind, joy follows him as his own shadow. Where the Dhammapada begins, I was really quite, in fact, totally surprised
to be reminded of that.
So all of this has to do with reflecting on the way, as we began all this issue, the three moments of time, reflecting on the way the future is actually in the present, whether you want to consider it in the form of seeds or as the natural outcome of the activities you perform in the present or anything like that. So I'm not sure, therefore, that I'm totally ready to go into talking about the future moment of time, and stop talking about the present, because I feel like they're not, in some way I can't disentangle them yet. I'm not quite ready to jump into the future, I'm still into the present in some way. And in particular, I think maybe I'm being confusing here. In particular, I'm still into this question of refuge. And I've been exploring my thoughts about refuge and about what does it mean to be taking refuge moment by moment in the present moment of whatever we happen to be doing. And I'd like to sort of like go back to that. But I don't exactly feel like, you know, sort of doing a discourse on refuge or something like that. I feel more like just talking about it. In spite of what I said earlier, maybe you can get dispensation to talk in class. Maybe that's okay. Yeah. Minimally. So frankly, I don't remember everything that I said last week. I mean, a sensible thing would have been listening to tapes in my own class. But I'm not sure I'm ready to, I'm not sure I can stand to listen to myself on tape yet. So I let that go and I'll have to trust in my own memory. But the idea that I recollect myself working with was I was trying to express my thought that actually taking refuge is about is not so much taking refuge in something external, the three gems of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, but actually that when one takes refuge, one takes refuge in one's own Buddha nature. But that's really what's going on. Because if you think about the way in which, say, in middle way thought, it's very hard to disentangle oneself from others, then it's kind of hard to disentangle oneself from the other, which is the three gems. So I think I'm being a little obscure here, so let me sort of try and de-obscurify what I'm trying to say. When we're in the Zendo and we come to this part where we recite the refuges, I think that the easy thing is to think that we're taking refuge in the Buddha who's out there, that we're taking refuge in the Dharma which somehow exists, it's written out in some form, that we're taking refuge in the Sangha, which is some sort of body of teachers or monks or predecessors or something, rather than actually our community. And it's just something about the way that the service goes that sort of conveys that. But I think if we fall into that way of thinking, that we're falling into a kind of fundamental misunderstanding about the relationship of oneself and others. And when it's sort of, in that sense, perpetuating a misunderstanding, perpetuating an error. Now, what I mean by this is that the way in which we know or experience ourselves is based upon our having a sense of others as separate from us. The way in which we know others as separate from us is seeing ourselves. I mean, we constantly get this sense of me only because we create a sense of other. And the only way we can create a sense of other is because we create a sense of me. I think that this kind of thing is sort of pretty well. That's not news. I think you understand what I'm talking about here. But there's a way, though, in which our practice is seeing through this rigid disconnection between ourselves and others, seeing how we, in fact, moment by moment, day by day, get our sense of ourselves based upon the others that are around us, how they define us, how they relate to us. We develop our sense of who we are really out of the time we spend with other people and the thoughts we have about the meanings of our interactions. Without those other people, there would be no way for us to have any kind of sense of who we are. So like Robinson Crusoe on a desert island, without anybody else around, our self-definition would evaporate in a certain way. It would go to pieces. We would, as we would say, go crazy. because we would have no actual sense of who we were anymore, because there'd be nobody around to create that for us. But if we approach taking refuge as taking refuge in an other outside of ourselves, following that kind of habit pattern, then I think we've lost track of refuge in a more alive way, which is that the object of refuge, the Buddha, right, is in fact the one who at one time was a human being who, well, I could say perfected himself, but if I say perfected himself, that creates some uncomfortableness for some people. So rather than say perfected himself, let me say that the Buddha is the one who removed from his mind stream all the negative habit patterns and developed all the positive habit patterns. And these negative habit patterns are sometimes called kleshas, Sanskrit word which refers to the impurities, if you will, or distorting processes in our minds.
Okay, those questions are
Something
about removed, when you mean something about removed, doesn't seem to feel
that.
But
when
you mean
removable?
Removed, you mean that they're still there, but he wasn't kind of cause and effect by them, he wasn't interacting on those negative patterns. So
no, it actually means they've been removed. And I'll try and elaborate.
Can you also say what negative and positive are defined with regard to?
Okay, I'll do that too. And this is obviously related to this don't think good thoughts, don't think bad thoughts issue of sort of this comment that the Sixth Patriarch makes when the general catches up with him and says, don't think good thoughts, don't think bad thoughts. And in that state of mind, what was your face before your parents were born?
I was going to say, the question comes up to my mind as to whether he would remove all habit and do everything fully conscious. Habit itself is like that verse I quoted last week from the commentary to the Abhata Sati, but it said quelling habit energy. Habit energy itself being
my guess would be that the habit energy referred to there is what's called samskara, or samskaras, that would have been the Sanskrit term for it. And negative samskaras are called kleshas. Sort of make this connection. But let me finish what I was doing and try and weave all these pieces together. And answer all the questions. Buddha is the one who's removed all the negative samskaras, or the kleshas, and has accumulated an inconceivable amount of merit, which is the positive habit patterns. That's what merit is. It's positive habit patterns. Now, when one says remove and accumulate, the essential part of a human being, the essential part of a being, let me put it that way, which is the part that goes from life to life, is what's called the mind, or the mind stream. And that means pure subjectivity, if you will, that aspect of oneself that knows or is aware. So if you're sitting zazen, whatever you're noticing in your experience is not that, because that is what's noticing everything. So it can never really notice itself in a certain way. Like the hand that can't grasp itself. That's the part of you which is said to be reborn. This has nothing to do with its nature of being empty or anything like that. That's sort of a side issue that I want to get into this particular moment. Sometimes it's called the mind stream. Sometimes it's called mental consciousness. In the Chittamatra teachings, it's called the storehouse consciousness, Alaya Vijnana. In Dzogchen teachings, it's called Rigpa, which is sort of like a Tibetan version of Zen, Dzogchen. It's called Rigpa. And in the Tantric teachings, it's called the clear light of death, or the mind stream. These are essentially all the same thing, although in each of these traditions, this subjectivity is described in slightly different terms. It's not like they agree 100%, but they're more, for our purposes in this class, anyhow, they're calling the same thing. Anyhow, the means whereby the habits are retained, if you will, without there being something upon which this continuity exists, there wouldn't be any basis for morality in the Buddhist system. There'd be no basis for saying that actions must bear fruit, because there has to be some place where there's a connection between the action and the fruit. And so, and in most Buddhist systems, it said the mind stream is the place of the connection. And somehow the habits influence the mind stream by leaving seeds. These are the seeds I was talking about removing, or affecting it in some way. Now, Buddhas, through their practice of altruism in various ways, remove negative habits and acquire merit. The other way of removing negative habits is through the practice of wisdom, without going into that distinction though, to try and answer, if I can remember now, the questions. Before I do that, when one takes refuge in the Buddha, if one does so in sort of the coarse consciousness of I am different than you, so therefore I'm me and Buddha is Buddha, someone who lived a long time ago and isn't around anymore, or someone who in the Mahayana sense is in some way still here but is other than me, okay. That's sort of a coarse form of taking refuge in an other outside of oneself. But if the actual nature of the Buddha is merely the purified mind stream, which in its nature is no different than what's within us, because we have a mind stream also, but unpurified, then fundamentally there's no difference between taking refuge in... Sorry. I forgot too. I was reminded by Sonia. Fundamentally, there's no difference in taking refuge in a Buddha or the Buddha, or taking refuge in one's own purified mind stream. In other words, one's potential Buddha nature. In fact, there's really nothing else to take refuge in. What else would there be to take refuge in? How can one take refuge in something external from oneself? Because how can something external from oneself fundamentally help oneself? I mean, really, the locus of help is an internal locus. Now, probably, when someone like Dogen says that really all you have to do is sit zazen, there's nothing else that's really necessary for practices, truly sitting zazen, what Dogen is saying is when you're truly sitting, when you're truly doing zazen, what's emerging in that experience is your Buddha nature, is that purified mind stream. So that's what's really sitting, that's what's really doing zazen. And that's why really doing zazen, in this sense, is really taking refuge. Or really taking refuge is really doing zazen. Or really remembering, actually, your relationship with yourself. Because I would say that the ultimate refuge is realizing, in that moment, your Buddha nature. Realizing your true nature. But since most of us don't do that, the next best thing we can do is, in that moment, remember that what we're really taking refuge in is our own higher self, our own true nature. Not taking refuge in something outside of oneself, but taking refuge in oneself in this way is taking refuge in one's own potential Buddhahood. Now, of course, there's traps in this kind of approach that I'm talking about, because I am talking about one's mind in its potential sense of being Buddha. But at the same time, I'm talking about one's mind as it is right now. Right? Because one's mind stream as it is right now is in fact in a certain way pure. I mean, one of the ways that one of my Tibetan teachers used to talk about it is he said that the taints on the mind stream are adventitious. And if they weren't, then they couldn't be removed. What that means is that the mind stream is like a white cloth that's been stained. But it can be washed, and the stains can be removed. If the stains were part of a cloth, if they were the if the cloth was that color, as it were, and it was not a stain, then it couldn't be removed. And if it couldn't be removed, then the mind couldn't be purified, and one couldn't become a Buddha. One couldn't get enlightened. Now, there's a little mental trick that we have to do with ourselves when we're thinking this way, though. Because on the one hand, if we think, well, I just take refuge in myself, I don't need a teacher, and I'm perfect and pure the way I am, on the one hand, that's totally true. But on the other hand, it's completely not true. The way it's completely true is the cloth really is white. But it's also completely true that the cloth really is stained. Right? So in this sense, to follow the metaphor, you can't really take refuge in a stained cloth. But you really can take refuge in a cloth which will be unstained. Now the real twist on all of this is that in fact taking refuge removes the stain. Because taking refuge is an activity of remembering your own higher self in any given moment. And when you're doing that, you can't be committing negative actions. And in fact, you are having positive thoughts. So in that moment of actually truly taking refuge, you really are eradicating negative thoughts. You really are, or negative samskaras, kleshas, you really are accumulating positive ones. Okay. So in that moment, you really are wholesomely taking refuge in, as it were, the white cloth rather than the stains. But you see, there's sort of like a trick on a trick that you have to be really cautious about in doing this. So I'm not sitting here saying that everyone gets to be their own guru. Because if you try and do that, I mean, that was a really popular kind of comment around California 10 years ago or so. You know, I'll be my own guru. I don't need a teacher. Well, fine. I mean, except there's this problem that all you've really got to communicate with, take refuge in a certain level, is this stained cloth. That doesn't work. But in another way, you really are your own guru. You really are taking refuge in your own higher self. You really can, in fact. That's the only thing you can take refuge in. But it's your higher self potentially. Now, let's see. I'm trying to remember if in this process I managed to answer the questions that you asked. Did I? I didn't. I got yours. Now the cloth is giving you hell?
Yeah.
All right, why don't we deal with that and then we'll come back to you. Alright, why is the clock giving you hell?
Well, it sounds like you're saying we have a fixed thing. Going back to this, we all have something there. That means there's something there to press onto. And yet we're told relentlessly there's nothing. You must be a part of everything. It's like somehow my mind's not clicking into your ability to teach, or I don't know, but it just keeps feeling that you keep going back to this. There is some seed that I carry with me, that it is
okay.
The self.
Well, the problem is the way we think about mind stream.
Okay.
We think about mind stream as if it's a thing. And in talking to you in English, I can't help but use the way English language works, which is to treat things as things, even if that's not what one really is trying to talk about. Okay. Now, the way to cut through this problem is to understand what's the thing, first off. So that when one thinks about the mind stream, or contemplates the mind stream, or practicing Zazen, one can be alert to the natural errors the mind will make when focusing on it. Because that's all that will happen initially, is you'll focus on your own nature or your own mind stream with your habitual habit patterns that come out of English language and training and so on and so forth. Now it's true, mind stream isn't all of those things. It's not a thing in the way in which we think about the thing. Although I talked about it in a way that makes it sound like it's a thing, I can't find any other way to talk about it. Okay. The nature of the mind stream is that it is, as Madhyamaka thought teaches, empty. devoid of inherent existence or devoid of autonomy. And what that means in a little richer terminology is, or maybe more sensible terminology. Little Richard? Well, there's a piano over here, but I can't play it.
I had to do a little glitch there, too, to make it obvious.
So, that's cute. God only knows what I haven't quoted him yet, but Stuart did a pretty good job.
No, I heard that. I was blah, 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 blah.
Okay. Time to end class on that note. Okay.
And a little richer term.
The problem with the way that we think about anything, including the mind stream, is that we see it, so these are the three characteristics, is that we see things as independent when they're actually dependent. We see things as unities when they're actually made of parts. And we see them as having their own characters when, in fact, everything that we can say about them or we believe them to have in the way of characters or characteristics is imputed on them by our own mind. And by here I mean our cognitive activity. So that includes our sort of attempts to understand our own mind stream. Practicing meditation or anything else. And we experience mind as, say, independent, but in fact, mind, I mean, try this in the Zendo in the next couple of days, is if you try and sort of focus back, turn the light backwards on itself, as the koans say, try and focus on pure, on your actual subjectivity. You can find it for a moment, for short periods of time, even if it's in its coarser form, which is the way you'll find it. It will seem to just be there. Just be there, okay? As if it didn't come from anywhere. As if it's always just been there and didn't depend on anything else. And if you reflect, it'll become clear to you that, for one thing, it has to depend on something, in the sense that within the context of what we mean by previous moment, it depends on a previous moment. I mean a previous moment in the Madhyamaka sense of a previous moment. But it didn't just come out of nowhere. Okay. That to say that it is dependent in this way is to say that it depends either on a previous moment or it depends on its relationship to the body, to yourself in some way. That mind isn't completely disembodied, it's not just floating out there in space. And according to Nagarjuna's analysis, to say that it's composed of parts is to say that actually it depends on future and past moments, because parts are not just spatial parts, by his analysis, they're what are called temporal parts. That he doesn't make the fundamental distinction between time and space that we do, so that you can see space is divided into parts, but time isn't. So the parts that consciousness is actually dependent on are parts in time. And what it's constructed of is parts in time. Language. The other thing that you notice in practicing is that when you try and focus on it, you'll bring some belief about what it is to the experience of trying to focus on it. Even if you don't think, oh, this is mind, even if you're just sort of noticing something, right? There'll be some cognition, some belief about nature of mind in the process of looking for it. These are the imputations of your own mind, of your own conceptual structure onto the mind stream. Okay. Now, when one talks about the mind stream in its own pure nature, it's free of these things. It's free of our thoughts about what its nature is. And so that's one reason why we can hardly ever find it. Okay. It's dependent, and it's composed of parts in a way which is completely non-obvious to us in our experience. We just see it as a given in an astounding way. If you can find it, you'll experience that. I mean, if you come to it with this sort of perspective, you'll experience that. And it's kind of like dumbfounding to realize how fundamentally, in this sense, erroneous and distorted our view is about what is most deeply us, in a way. I don't know how to be any clearer, to the extent that's clear, about it than that. Although he's not saying that you shouldn't think good thoughts. He's saying if you want to...
Yeah, if you want to see through both sides, I believe that. I mean, that's what I've been trying to do for the last week. That what you describe is kind of like... Not that I've got it, right? It's just that this feeling comes of the pollution that I accept all the time. It's like it's a little bit more...
Okay, well, this pollution that you're talking about are like the stains that I was talking
it's
about
me,
earlier.
That's right. That's why
right.
I'm
well, see, the thing is, though, you have to be careful when it says, don't think good thoughts, don't think bad thoughts. He's not saying that you should never think good thoughts. Mm-hmm. What he's saying is, from the point of view of trying to ascertain your face before your parents were born, you have to get beyond any kind of thing. Right. But he isn't any place in here saying you shouldn't have good thoughts. Because if you actually read through the Platform Sutra, the Sixth Patriarch, it's full of references to the acquisition of merit, making offerings, having good thoughts, and this kind of stuff. He's saying in this particular situation, right, if you want to ascertain this, then you have to get beyond thinking positive or negative thoughts. You have to get beyond what you call the pollution or the stains, at least in that moment, then you can ascertain it clearly.
Which is not no thinking.
What do you mean?
Not non-thinking, that you have to, as I understood it and can remember it, is that thoughts will continually arise. And to stop thinking is actually a deluded thought.
Oh, yeah, he talks about
okay,
that.
So it's like not non-thinking.
Right. Because when you hold yourself in the stance of, I'm not going to think, that's a cognitive position, that's a stance. It's like the stance of, look for your original face. It's an injunction. And as such, it's a thought form, even though it's a subtle thought form. You're right. So when he talks about getting beyond thinking, getting beyond non-thinking, and he's also saying getting beyond the injunction not to think, which is to actually resolve oneself into one's original mind. Now, that's why I like that word, resolve oneself into things. It's just like slither back into without sort of rigidly holding a stance in some way. Unfocus the distinctions.
And a couple of questions. One was, what is the actual language for this? Did he, in the case, he doesn't actually say, don't think good thoughts, don't think bad thoughts, does he?
I don't know. What I have here is only Ruman's comments on it. I mean, there's, you know, in the week between last week and this week, the week between last class and this class, I was looking at various translations of the Platform Sutra. Since I don't read Chinese, that's all I can do. In this, I can read what the koan says.
Just that one line, because I thought when you read it the first time, it said something that, like, when you don't think good thoughts or when you don't think bad thoughts, what is the...
Yeah. Well, I read two translations last time, so... I read this one and another, so it's hard to say. And since then, I've come up with a third to look through. But here he says, so this is the moment where this, you know, this monk is trying to pick up the robe and he can't. And the monk said, I've come for Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, please teach me, O lay brother. The sixth patriarch said, think neither good nor evil. At such a moment, what is the true self of Monk Miao? That's what this one says.
Maybe it's overly simplified, but in the past I have interpreted that, you know, in the light of not picking and choosing. Don't think good, don't think evil. It isn't, don't have beneficial thoughts, don't have corrosive thoughts, but don't, without being caught up in, I like this, I don't like this, this is good, this is bad, without being caught up in judgment, in that case, which has some sense of, in some sense it sounds easier to do, but it isn't particularly easy to do. The production of preferential judgments is fairly continuous and seem to arise every moment. So it seems, in some respects, though, a little easier to do than not having any thoughts. Well, the thoughts arise, but not being involved in that kind of thinking.
Well, I don't.
Not caught up in.
Yeah. Well, I could say not getting caught up in preferential thinking in the way you defined it, or not thinking good thoughts and not thinking bad thoughts. Probably these are connected with each other and not disconnected from each other. And that not being caught up in it is probably easier than not having the thoughts at all. But I think that also there's some reference to not having the thoughts. The issue that makes this really, in my mind, what makes this really complicated is the assertion that the five skandhas are what we are. And one of the five skandhas is called Vedana skandha. And what it refers to is that everything in our experience is got this vector of either it's good or it's bad or it's ambivalent. That every thought we have, every feeling, well, Vedana means feeling, right? That every experience, every moment that we exist has a feeling tone to it. Maybe it's a better way to phrase it. Every moment of our existence has a feeling tone to it, which is either a positive tone or a negative tone or an ambivalent tone, which is to say that the two are balanced in such a way that we don't feel ourselves pulled one way or the other. But there's no moment without feeling tone. And in that sense, there's no, as long as one is a human being, there's no time that attractive or repulsive thoughts don't arise in some way. And so then the point of not getting entangled in them might be realistic. But to not have them, is that possible? Becomes a big question. Well, what enlightenment is about, I mean, within the context of talking about the five skandhas, and so it's usually this is a conversation that sort of like a Hinayana conversation. Okay. What enlightenment is about is when the five skandhas are no longer capable of functioning, as it were. It's like in the Theravada scriptures, the Buddha is said to have sort of like when you break the ridge beam, what is it called? There's like in a hut, there's a pole that runs across the roof pole, right? What do we call ridge beam? Okay. When you break the ridge beam, there's just the roof can't hold. Okay. And so enlightenment is like breaking the ridge beam, and so the structure of the personality, the five skandhas, is broken. It can't hold. And in that moment, the feeling tones, the consistent feeling tones, are non-operational, if you will. That would be the kind of moment, I think, that Hui Ning is talking about when he says, you know, get beyond that and see into what you actually are. What is the face you had before your parents were born? It's like that's the moment of enlightenment. That's when the ridge beam is broken, the ridge pole is broken in some way. I don't know, I feel like we're getting kind of far afield here. I'm not sure if I've answered you. I obviously haven't answered your question.
Well, I've had a couple more questions. I wanted to ask you about the relationship between ordinary mind and this mind stream that you're talking about. I think when you were answering Chris's question earlier, you were talking about the mind stream, right? The white cloth, Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's dependently co-arisen. It's empty in all the ways that everything else is empty.
Right.
So can you say something more about what the relationship is between our ordinary, delusional, ignorant mind and this Buddha nature mind stream?
Yeah, our ordinary mind is the stained cloth.
Yeah, I get that, but that's not so helpful.
Okay. Okay, there is another skanda. There is this skanda called the samskara skanda. And it's the Theravadin way of talking about the fact that what our personalities are is a mass of habit patterns. In sort of like modern social science or psychological jargon, we say that what our personalities are is the sum total of all of our experience of our lifetime, our education, the child-rearing practices of our parents, the effect of every TV program we've ever watched, every book we've ever read, every relationship we've had with every person, all the sum total of all of that stuff is actually what our personality is. And that personality, or that sum total of habitual experiences, is constantly producing discernments of this is attractive or that's not attractive. And that's the nature of habit patterns. You know, it's like we talk about having wholesome habits or unwholesome habits. So, I mean, the habit of eating cookies in the evening produces the eating of cookies in the evening. You know what I mean? What I'm trying to say here is if you, in some way, you can divide human being into their personality and their pure mind. And it's like their personality is producing all the stuff, the froth, if you will, which is covering over the mind stream. So everything about our personality represents a covering of the mind stream because it represents the manifestation of, or its manifestation is in thought, attraction, repulsion, certain types of thoughts, and all this kind of thing. So essentially, really, what the program here is in Dharma is, in a certain way, eradicating aspects of our personality, actually. And to the extent that we don't eeradicate them, stepping beyond them, stepping beyond their influence.
Well, I was thinking more of it as saying when you're sitting zazen and your ordinary mind is just going through all of its stuff. Where is this other mind?
It's right there. Let me use a different analog, a different analogy. When you go to the movies, there's this whole drama that ends up on your screen. If you want, you can consider your ordinary mind, all the thoughts, feelings, what have you, that are generally occurring. That's like the images, the moving images. Okay. And you could consider, following this analogy, if you'd like, that this mind that I'm talking about, the mind stream, is like the screen on which this stuff is projected. Or if you prefer, you could consider it the light which runs through the celluloid film. So before the light hits the film, it's white and it's got no impressions. After the light hits the celluloid film, as it's shooting out of the lens, it's got all this light and impressions on it, which you don't see until it hits the screen. But the difference between the light on one side of the celluloid film and the light on the other side is like the difference between our minds as such and our minds as imprinted by the activity of the habit patterns. I think that's pretty good.
Can you tell the difference? Can you experience this, the white cloth, independently of experiencing the stained cloth?
Well, I think that, so here I can only reference my own experience, actually. I mean, rather than speaking theoretically, it seems to me that the less colored the light is, it's quite self-evident in one's experience when the light is more or less colored. That it shows itself to you. It doesn't require any explanation. It's like when you're sitting zazen, you know, you have times when you're sitting zazen and you know you're in the muck. And then there's times when you sort of like know you're out of the muck. That doesn't require any, I mean, it's clear, right? I mean, it's just, boy, you know it. And the deeper you go within yourself, or the closer you get to this, there are signs of it that are relatively clear. Now, Rev has talked actually about a lot of them. He talked about the six subtle Dharma gates. I mean, he and I had this conversation. And I can't remember which Dharma gates are which, but there's a certain point where he talks about reversal. I think it's the fourth.
Return.
Okay. When one hits that particular point, when you get into that experience of return, okay, you're into an experience of settling into subtler aspects of the mind and being freed from coarser aspects, which is to say you're being freed from these kind of the color in the light, if you will, and you're getting into the light itself. And apparently what the sixth subtle Dharma gate refers to is the experience of coming back into the world with the ability of the cloth not ever getting stained again. To mix all kinds of metaphors together. But the point in answering your question is, it's like when you run into Bodhi, in my experience, it's sort of like a big neon light that comes on that flashes Bodhi. It's like there's no doubt about what it is when you run into it, because it has the characteristic of wisdom. It has the characteristic of sort of like transcendental knowing what's what. Like what's going on around you and who you are and where's the bullshit. And it's there so distinctly that it's not a matter of discerning is it or isn't it it. Because it's just like, that's it. It doesn't play any games with you. The thing is that you can run into a lot of things before you get there that seem like that's it. But if you're honest and really ask yourself a simple question, which is to say, did I think that? Or was that something, that sort of sense that I had, was that something that I knew in the way in which I ordinarily know things? Like, did it have the characteristic of my understanding in the way in which I usually understand? If the answer to that question is yes, then it wasn't Bodhi. And almost always the answer to the question will be yes. And when Bodhi shows up, you don't have to ask the question anymore. It's just clear. I don't know how else to say that. It's unmistakable.
I was just going to suggest that that's where the teacher comes in really handy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's where a teacher comes in really handy. You're right. Good point. Thank you. Yeah, to discern that. Yeah, to discern that. Yeah, because there's lots of places where there's confusion. And I suppose it's conceivable that when the Bodhi light comes on, you might not know it. But I don't think that that's the problem. I think the problem is more in the other area, which is you think that the Bodhi light got switched on and that it wasn't. And you need somebody around to say, no, that's not what it was. That was nice, but that's not what it was. But the other one, you know it. But of course, obviously, there's this difficulty in that sometimes you think it was and it wasn't. So I don't know. I guess I feel like I'm not giving you any handle on this particular problem. I mean, once you've seen it, maybe that's maybe this is the point. Once you've seen it, once you got a good look at it, you don't have to ask the question again, because you know the difference. You just know the difference. I mean, all you need is just one glimmer of seeing it, and after that, you don't make that mistake ever again. Unfortunately, you spend years sitting around saying, "That's not it. That's not it. That's not it." It's kind of frustrating.
I was just going to suggest it in a sort of more abstract way, though, the song that you will mirror Samadhi at the beginning, when you array them, they're not the same. When you mix them, you know where they are. So after the teaching of thusness, the teaching of thusness has been intimately communicated. Mm-hmm. And at that point,
yeah. There. Okay.
I'm just wondering if it would be helpful at this point to talk about the difference a little bit between the subtle mind and the very subtle mind, and in that you can experience the subtle mind in your meditation process, but that the very subtle mind can only be experienced at death or when you attain the illusory body or lose it. Right? So when you're saying, talking about Buddha, you're not actually talking about experiencing the very subtle mind. You're talking about the subtle mind because you're not going to the death process.
Right. That's true, that's true, but I didn't really want to get into that.
Okay. Well, I just thought because the way you were making it sound, though, is that you could actually experience the very subtle mind or the mind stream.
Well, that's why I said Bodhi instead.
Okay.
I mean, everything that Kay said is correct. It's just that I think to get into that is actually going to make things more confusing rather than more clear, frankly. Because that involves really getting into a whole analysis of the Vajrayana view of the nature of mind, which is not exactly something I think I don't want. I don't think I want to do that. Did I answer your question?
Yes, but now, since Kay wrapped that up, you're in big trouble.
Yes,
Stuart.
Well,
I'll talk to you later.
Yes, Stuart, but then let me do one more question, then I want to get back to refuge. Yeah.
Not a question, but a comment. I think that it's that issue is treated in Dogen's injunction. You must drop body and mind. It's the dropping of body. So there's all kinds of awakening, there's all kinds of insight, there's all kinds of stuff that goes on.
Mm.
But the Dogen's notion of awakening is the dropping of body.
Yeah, that sounds right. Because when you drop body and mind in that sense, it means a coarser kind of mind. It doesn't mean it's really subtle. It doesn't mean Bodhi mind. Or as Kay is saying, it doesn't mean that you're dropping the very subtle mind. Means you're dropping something else. That's a good analogy. Thank you for reminding me of that. Okay.
I was thinking of this thing playing a little bit between Kristen's and Pam's question, but the thing that came up about removing habit patterns or whatever, and what you were saying, I was playing with the word removing, and it's kind of like, again, moving it. It's like you move these habit patterns, and so what I think you start to see is your relationship. That kind of what I feel like changes. In that kind of sense, when you talk about removing them, maybe they eventually kind of don't have much pull, or they're more neutral, and so it's removed in that way, and then it doesn't get fixed. And a lot of several things, but anyway, the one other thing I want to say is that came up for me as you were talking, and maybe it's just because it's the beginning of your speaking, but the way, and back to what you're saying about taking refuge, when we take refuge, it's like taking this refuge in all three, and then build on and support or interact with each other. So in a way, just to talk about the Buddha nature without then saying, but there's also Dharma, which is the practice that kind of, keeps the loop going, which is again the Sangha, or, how those all fit together. So even if you think, it seems to me, or feel that you've had some awakening, if it doesn't turn and then you're not actually waking you know, it's not having some kind of interactive manifestation, maybe with Sangha or the world, then it's kind of back to work again or something. Somehow there's a loop in there for me.
What I thought of as you were saying this was that taking refuge in Dharma on a moment-by-moment basis is remembering to do it. I mean, remembering the teaching, which is what Dharma is, remembering the teaching is remembering to take refuge in your Buddha nature moment-by-moment. That actually is taking refuge in Dharma. Because Dharma is the teaching of what do you do moment by moment. So as you said, as you're remembering this, just remembering to do it is taking refuge in the teaching, because it's embodying the teaching. And the taking refuge in the teaching from the point of view of the loop that you're talking about, this is the place where the present grows into the future, where you're acting for the benefit of Sangha. But rather than sort of turning it that way, I want to turn it back to the question, because I want to resolve the question. Not resolve the question, go back to the question of taking refuge in one's own true self, which is taking refuge in the Buddha or one's Buddha nature on a moment-by-moment basis. Because, I mean, that's kind of the focus that I wanted to do in this class, which is that the practice that I'm advocating here is really no different than the practice of truly doing zazen moment by moment, whether you're sitting on a cushion or not. But I'm sort of describing it in a particular way, which is in every given moment taking refuge, which is to say remembering what your actual nature is, doing no more than remembering what your actual nature is. Now, in this context, it would be called having good thoughts. But it's having good thoughts in the sense of taking a stance. Okay, it is producing a positive thought rather than a negative thought. So in that sense, one probably wouldn't say that it's true zazen in the sense of simply being your own nature. Okay, it is, I think, zazen in the same way as zazen is remembering to sit up straight, remembering to sit upright. Okay. This is mentally remembering to sit upright. Mentally remembering to sit upright is remembering what your real posture is. Your real posture is the posture of what you really are. This is the sort of. So in my experience, you know, whether it's cutting carrots or washing dishes or stirring the soup, part of me can be doing what I'm doing, but another part of me is remembering that there's a part of me in there at that time watching the soup being stirred, the carrots being cut. And that's the part of me that I'm really taking refuge in. Now, what I experience when I'm doing that, however, is that we just got through saying, it's like I'm practicing the Dharma because I'm remembering to take refuge. But then the next part of the loop emerges, which is that the activity that I'm engaged in, when I'm in this stance, when I'm remembering, when I'm taking refuge in this way, the activity that I'm engaged in becomes an activity which actually is an altruistic activity. It's an activity in which the seed that is sprouting out of that moment, the future that's coming out of that moment, or to use the expression in the Dhammapada, the shadow that, here, if a man speaks or acts with a pure mind, joy follows him as his shadow. It's like the shadow which is naturally there in the posture, or what naturally emerges, has a quality of positivity in what I call Sangha building. Okay, because again, my experience is that if I'm simply cutting the carrot or simply stirring the soup, there could actually be a lot of joy in doing that with real consciousness and real awareness, real equanimity. You know, that's really a joyful experience, and quite wonderful. But it doesn't really have anything to do with generating an altruistic. It's not really an altruistic activity. But if I'm in that sort of state of mind, with this kind of remembering of my own higher nature, of my own Buddhahood, then what seems to naturally emerge in that process is to see the activity in a completely different context. Because the other context that emerges is the third gem, is the Sangha gem. And you, and in my experience, what you really get is you get this pot is not just sitting here, right? This soup is not just sitting here. It's here for a reason. And just as we talked about, it got here out of the past. It emerged, if you will, from the past. Or it has the past in it. As we talked about, it having the entire farm crew in the soup. So in the soup in that moment, that you're taking refuge in this way, that you're remembering in this way, the Sangha appears. Because the purpose of the soup being there is to feed the Sangha. And the entire body of the Sangha appears in the soup at that moment as the reason why the soup is there. The point of the soup appears at that moment. And I don't even know how to express this. The whole quality of the activity becomes, again in my experience, becomes what's called the acquisition of merit. It becomes a meritorious activity. Because the activity becomes purposeful in the sense of understanding that what it does, at least in the case of the soup, what it does is it really nourishes a body of beings whose purpose is taking refuge, is remembering, is cultivating bodhi, whatever you want to say it. That one really is supporting people in that activity. Now, you know, Buddhahood doesn't just appear anywhere. Buddhahood appears as people. Bodhi mind appears as people. Right? And people are a Sangha. I mean, they are, you know, it appears as a Sangha. It appears in the Sangha. The Sangha requires being cared for. So what I'm saying is, it's not just that in the abstract one takes refuge in one's own Buddha nature when stirring the soup. But in a concrete way, one's actually in the stream of tangibility, you know, contributing to the manifestation, if you will, of Buddhahood around here. Because it won't happen any other way.
It's a little bit what's happening in my mind is like the soup's nourishing the people so they can nourish people so that people can nourish the world. And it's just like the vastness that we've got. Like, somehow it's been in the clip a little bit about, mm-hmm. about how we can save all beings. You know, that's like,
right. Yeah, that's right. It's a pyramid scheme. But that's exactly it.
It's totally like overwhelming.
That's well, but it's not because you
well,
just comprehended it.
I can only get so far within
the boundaries of far. But it's pretty far. Because as you point out, it's in saving one being, you're saving all beings. Right? And it's just as if we look into the past, I mean, I know we've sort of deconstructed the idea of looking into the past, but if you think about how all these vast streams of things have come together to the present moment and the present pot of soup, right? And it's like this vast pyramid whose base is the past way out there. And so I just sort of like come down to this point of the present. Well, then, from the point of view of merging into the future, it is like that. It really is saving all beings in that respect. Yeah, I've had that experience too. It's pretty incredible. Because this whole bodhisattva sense of just that is right there. I don't know a better way to express it than the way you did yourself.
So sitting zazen in order to... sitting zazen as taking refuge is really only taking refuge when it's done with the thought of merit, of
acquiring merit and putting it forth?
Could be, but I'm not quite thinking of it in that way. I'm thinking that the causal connection is inverted, more in the way Chris was talking about it, which is that
the conscious thought of this is happening for the benefit of all beings, like that, like making all that connection, that's not really necessary, just the breathing actually.
Well, no, I'm not trying to say that. I mean, you could sit and hold the good thought of I'm doing this for the benefit of all beings, and that's certainly generating merit. But what I'm suggesting is that if you sit with the thought of what it means to take refuge in your higher self and do no more than that and experience that, okay, then what naturally emerges out of that experience is meritorious activity. It's not like you're sitting and trying to do some sort of meritorious activity, but rather you're sitting and what you're doing is connecting with yourself in the deepest sense. And when you do that in a way in which the connection is truly made, then all the activity that emerges from that moment is meritorious activity. Because having connected with your own truest self, your deepest self, then you see the kind of thing that Chris is talking about. You see the way in which the action that you're performing in the moment is an action that's wholesome because it's performed in the context of refuge. And as a wholesome action, it's an action which benefits, which is beneficial. It does, in fact, generate merit. It does, in fact, sustain people. It does, in fact, create sangha. It's what's actually called bodhicitta. That's what actual bodhicitta is. Some people talk about bodhicitta as the intention to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Okay. Some people talk about bodhicitta as an unsupported thought. Okay. But here what I'm saying is what bodhicitta is when you have the thought of truly taking refuge. And it's not just an abstract thought, but you truly take refuge when you have the moment of experience of your own pure self, okay, your own unpolluted self, if you will. Or if you just remember it, even though you don't totally experience it, at that moment, the activity that you're performing emerges as a very different kind of activity, as the Dhammapada says, it's like the shadow is just right there. You can't help but have a shadow right there. Or when it says that, speaking of the negative, that suffering follows him as the wheel of the cart follows the beast. Well, in the same way, positive would follow him. It just comes out naturally. What else can I say? And it's not a matter of like intentionally, I'm going to do this good thing. It's just that the action becomes a wholesome action because of the mental stance that you have in that moment and nothing else is required. That's what I'm trying to say. But I can't say it as well as Chris said it.
But the platform suit dreams is the lamp and light. Like one is the substance and one is the function. Like you couldn't have light using the lamp without the lamp or light without the lamp. Things like that shadow. The two are just so intimate.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can weave that in.
I'm trying to shift gears to incorporate that metaphor. Not real successfully, but I know that it's right.
That metaphor is a metaphor about mind.
But couldn't you raise the mind of bodhicitta?
That's a metaphor about mind and about the levels of mind, and the metaphor of the shadow has more to do about cause and effect. Or
It's the shade covering the flame. Mm-hmm.
One other thing that I wanted to talk about this evening. that, and then we'll just wrap it up. And that is, we're always burning incense around here and offering incense. A lot of times we do bows, and sometimes we offer water, and we offer food, and so on and so forth. And I think that must strike a lot of people as pretty damn weird, actually. And so I wanted to speak a little bit about what it means to understand that in every given moment of actually taking refuge, what's the nature of the activity that occurs in that moment? That's right.
That's right.
The nature of the activity that occurs in the moment that one is taking refuge is, in fact, an offering to the Sangha. Okay. Every activity that occurs in the moment of truly taking refuge is, in fact, an offering. Because if you think about it, that's what it is. It isn't anything else. It's literally a, this is performed for that. All right? This is being given to that. You know, this food is being given to these people. This weed is being pulled for the purpose of that. Okay? And what is, that's what an offering is. It's a gift in a certain way. Right? Now, here I'm talking about a gift for the future. Or, if you don't like to think of the future as over there, I'm talking about creating the circumstance in the present so a future can naturally emerge from it of a certain type. Another way of talking about it. But it's an offering. And what offering incense does, right, to the extent that we're in the dualistic state of me and it, there's Mr. Buddha over there and there's Mr. Me over here and I'm offering a stick of incense, it does remind us of something a little bit, but it's not very sophisticated. It's a pretty coarse way of remembering something. But it's a place to start. And if one remembers in offering the incense, well, it's not a matter of me here, him there, or me here, her there, or however you want to think of it, right? It's a matter of oh, this is remembering the relationship between the coarse and the subtle, between the lower me and the higher me, between the confused me and the unconfused me, between the stained cloth and the unstained cloth, whatever you want. It's a way of remembering. Just like, oh, I have to remember to take refuge in this moment, and then this is a different kind of moment. Okay. The making of an offering, like the offering of the incense, is a metaphor for how to live any given moment in terms of making the activity an offering. And you can make the activity an offering to the Buddha nature, or to the Sangha, or anything that you want. But the whole point of this kind of activity is a simple remembering. Yes, David.
Something just occurred to me. It's like it's running through my mind all night, and the thing of the idea of giving. I heard it's like giving up. You're actually giving up. Thinking of the sutra, the sixth patriarch, and what he says so blatantly, there's no cloth.
Well, when he says there's no cloth,
he said there's no mirror, there's no dust.
But when he's saying that, he's saying there's no cloth in the sense of saying like the cloth is empty. Saying like the cloth is empty of or devoid of independence, autonomy, you know, selfhood, our projections about its nature. He's not saying that the cloth is non-existent. I mean, you just got that one wrong, David.
He was awakened by the Diamond Sutra.
Right.
There's clear use of no there.
Even the poem about the Bodhi tree, there is no Bodhi tree.
Yeah.
And there never
that's
was,
what he means. He means.
There is no mirror.
Yeah. There's
no mirror.
Yeah. Yeah. But
and there is no mind in
He said, his famous cliche, or whatever he calls it, from the beginning. I said from the beginning, not a single thing is.
That's right. But
from the beginning, not a single thing is. And our nature is totally devoid of anything, any kind of whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, that's when I've been talking about the mind stream in its purest sense. Now, wait a minute. You see, when I've been talking about
pure.
Now, wait a minute.
How can nothing be
pure? Are you going to give me a chance to answer your question?
No.
Okay. when I've been talking about mind stream in its nature unstained, okay, if you will, the potential Buddhahood in all of us, that's the kind of thing that sixth ancestor refers to when he says, it's never been there at all. Like, there's been no mind from the very beginning. Okay? He does not mean that it's never existed. What he means is it's never existed in a fundamentally stained way. That the stains are adventitious. Okay? Now,
what does adventitious mean?
It means circumstantial, accidental, if you will, or layered onto something, but not in its nature. Okay. So when he says that the mirror never was, right, he doesn't mean that it's never existent. Right?
Why not?
Because if it never existed, then you never existed.
I never said I did.
But who the hell is sitting here?
It's a question of identity. Right? If we're talking about identity, about our true nature, our true identity. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm all for finding out who it is, who I am. I'm all for it.
Are you thinking of Atman? I get the impression that what you're arguing against is.
I'm not arguing. I'm not trying to argue. I'm not trying to be whatever. I'm just saying that. You know, you're saying, well, what are we something? Are we nothing? What's our true nature? Are we basically empty? Are we totally empty?
It depends what you mean by empty, David. And
I mean empty, man. Clear, void, bright, whatever.
What would be bright? If we're clear, void, and bright, what's clear, what's bright? If there's nothing. But nothing can't be clear or bright, nothing's nothing. Right?
Well,
clear and bright are qualities. Wait. Yeah, no, you're not going
to
escape that way now. Clear and bright. David, clear and bright are qualities, aren't they? They're characteristics. Clear and bright are characteristics, aren't they?
Well, I'm trying to describe what it is that we are. I'm trying to describe what it is that we are. Now, if you say we're nothing.
I didn't say that.
Okay, if I say we're nothing, you know, people will get no conception. But I'm just trying to sort of form my feeling.
I understand.
For what I've experienced, or what seems to be basically obvious.
I don't think there's anything obvious about it.
Well, he says, from the beginning, not a thing is. He says, from the beginning, there's no mirror tree. The name of this sutra is the Zen doctrine of no mind.
Well,
it's called the supreme doctrine, no mind, no nothing.
But it doesn't mean no nothing, right? It means no independent mind. It means no mind in the way in which you think you have a mind.
Is Buddha mind dependently co-risen?
Absolutely.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've never heard that.
Oh, really? Don't you remember the story about the fox? You remember the story about the fox?
It's
a koan.
I've heard this.
Okay. If you say that Buddha mind is dependent, is not in the stream of cause and effect.
That's the point. I would never say that because I cannot speak. I am nothing. How can I speak?
You're speaking right now.
But see, that's your conception of what I'm doing. Now I've got to speak for what? Well, I've got to speak for my truth. My truth is that although you may hear words and though it may feel to me like I'm speaking, I know that I am not speaking because simply there is no eye, no ears, no nose, no tongue, How can I speak by the tongue?
Therefore, an emptiness is none of these things.
There's none of these things.
An emptiness. But, David, I don't know how to cut through it. You know, I have to say, with all love.
Fragile sword.
Okay. with all love, I've got to say that you're rooted in the most tenacious way.
No.
You are rooted in the most tenacious way.
Go ahead.
What do they call that? His personal attack or something. Or some
Seriously, David, I say this with great affection. I do. I say it with great affection.
There's a word for that.
That ain't the word. Because really, this does come out of affection. It's not that common attack. Fact is, I'm just telling you that my experience is that you're really rigidly attached to a certain quality of nihilism, which is really tough to deal with.
It's not nihilism.
In my experience, that's what it is.
I'm not trying to say that there's nothing.
I'm saying
my identity, my true identity, is empty of all of everything.
That sounds like I agree with that.
Okay, great.
But that's not what you were saying earlier. You know,
I have a hard time expressing myself.
Okay.
I'm saying my identity is empty, and that my true identity does not speak.
My true identity does not
burn his hand on the stove.
Okay, that also.
That is my true identity. It's not an idea. It's not a minor part of my identity. It's my true identity.
Okay. Well, see, then the problem is the way you're expressing yourself using the Buddhist language of I have no mind, I have no this, I have no that. The way you're expressing it then was unskillful because it came across sounding nihilistic. No, that's not ad hominem. It's a critique of the way in which you were using language and confusing me. Because now the way you shifted to use language is not confusing, and I find that I agree with you. So there was something unskillful about the earlier statements you made.
Well, yeah, I'm not very, very good at expressing this. It's a hard thing to express.
I agree.
Yeah.
But what I'm cautioning you about is being careful about the kind of statements you're making.
Okay, but what about the white cloth and the
okay,
cloth?
If you use the metaphor, the white cloth and the stained
Where
cloth.
Where is the no cloth part?
The no cloth in the sense in which I mean no cloth, which is in accordance with a rather strict Madhyamaka notion of what no means. And no means no independence, right, so on and so forth in the ways in which I've described it. It doesn't mean non-existent. Okay. The no cloth, if you will, that's the white cloth. It's the unstained cloth. It's the mirror that never was fundamentally, if you want to use that kind of language. The stained cloth is the mirror as it appears, the appearance mirror.
So no cloth is white cloth?
Yeah, all right. No cloth is white cloth. White cloth means
no
cloth with no stains. That's what no cloth is. It's cloth with no stains.
Mm-hmm. I was just scarring.
So next week is our last class. So
it
can be at 7 o'clock. And the whole class will be on Chris's comment. The whole class will be on Chris's comment about what real bodhisattva activity is.
Okay.
But it should.
Well, I mean, if, you know, you encapsulated what the whole point was in terms of the future, the point of what it means to practice in the present from the point of view of what the seed is of the future. So, you want to teach a class? You've got it pretty clearly.
Just
to
pull up on my geometry a little bit.
It means no activity in the sense of no activity as it appears to be. You. No activity as appears to be.